Welcome, my name is John Ligree. Some of you have already heard me introduced, but I'm a registrar and also in the Department of Religion at St. Olaf College. That's in Northfield, Minnesota. All 3.5-day drive, which we took, but it was fun. The topic for today, as announced on the bulletin board, is called A Late Night Visit. I was told that catchy titles are in at Holden, and also the use of colons, so it's Luke, colon, A Late Night Visit. Now, before we get into things more, I think we should be aware that there is a theme here at Holden during the summer, which is faith to go out with good courage. And I think this particular text or passage very well fits that theme. And I won't go into that now because I think it will become more evident as we get into the details of the passage. But just bear that in mind, that that is an overarching theme here, and we do want to address that theme and point to it where it is relevant and appropriate. And now, there is a book in the bookstore that was ordered. It's called Luke. It's really a proclamation commentary. It's by Danker. And when I looked yesterday, there were 9 copies on the shelf. I don't know if there are more or not, but anyway, there are 9 there. I just wanted to say a couple of things about this little paperback. It's not very expensive. I think it's just $2.95 or so. It's not a blow-by-blow, passage-by-passage book in the normal sense of a commentary, even though it is in this Proclamation Commentary series. It is more of a thematic approach to the Gospel of Luke. As many of you probably know, Luke the Evangelist wrote not only the Gospel of Luke, but also the Acts of the Apostles. This week, anyway, we are just going to focus on the Gospel. And this commentary is just on the Gospel. It does not get into Acts, really, except by comparison with a few passages, perhaps, that naturally come into play. But as you read this, you may or may not find appropriate references to some of the passages that we are discussing here. For example, the one today, there's not a great deal of discussion in here about it. But that's not the intent of the book. Rather, it's to look for a theme in the Gospel as a whole. And you'll see that the concept that Danker stresses is that of benefaction. Jesus as benefactor. And you'll have to read it to see what he really means by that. That's the concept. And then within that framework of Jesus as benefactor, there's the theme of salvation as an overarching theme that Danker sees in the third gospel. Now, the extent to which a particular passage fits into that theme varies, of course, depending on the passage. There are other theologians who have also picked up the same theme of salvation. I.H. Marshall is one who has written a book called Luke, Historian and Theologian, where he feels salvation is the overarching theme and tries to show that throughout, you know, kind of what's called a systematic treatment. So this book is available, and it will bear on some of our passages at some points. Other times it will not, but if you want to get kind of an overview, a feel for what Luke is thinking about and what he's trying to get at, I think it's a helpful introduction. Okay. It's also in the library. I think you can check it out. You don't have to buy it. I think I saw one copy there. I haven't had a chance, since I'm one of the new group that arrived just yesterday, I haven't had a chance really to look through your library very much. But I know that can be checked out. I'm sure there'll be other books, and I'll browse through and maybe refer to some other books perhaps tomorrow morning that can also tie in with our theme and approach this week. Okay, now, there are many ways to do Bible study, and the approach I generally want to use is that of problem solving, that of raising questions and our working together to try to answer the questions or problems and to get some key questions directly applicable, of course, to the passage and see where that leads us. In order to do that, naturally, we need a framework. And I think we'll start by simply reading the passage for today. So if you turn in your RSVs, I guess that's what most of you have. There are more Bibles here. For those who came in later, I think there are a few still on the rack there as you come in the door. If you turn to Luke chapter 11. Now, can we have someone with a good, strong voice who wants to volunteer to read this? Chapter 11, verses 5 through 8.
And he said to them, "Which of you who has a friend will go to him at midnight and say to him, 'Friend, lend me 3 loaves, for a friend of mine has arrived on a journey and I have nothing to set before him.' And he will answer, from within, 'Do not bother me. The door is now shut. My children are with me in bed. I cannot get up and give you anything.' I tell you, though he will not get up and give him anything because he is a friend, yet because of his importunity, he will rise and give him whatever he needs. And I tell you, ask and it will be given you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you."
Okay, that's enough. Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay. Now, I handed out a sheet, and by the way, at the end of the session, would you please leave the sheet, because we are going to use the same sheet again tomorrow, and we don't know how many there will be, and I guess we thought it would be a good idea to leave that. You can see, of course, from the second half of the sheet, the parable that will be the topic for discussion tomorrow, if you want to do any reading on that tomorrow. And so, if you just remember to leave it when you leave today. Okay, now, if you look at the top half of that sheet for a minute, the sheet is arranged, or rather this passage is arranged in a way that will show that there is some literary character to the passage. If you just kind of look at the way it's outlined, what observations do you make? Just from a sense of literary, the way it's organized and so on. Are there any things that stick out or things you want to kind of pop out at you? Following a proper sequence? Okay. Yeah. Other observations.
It has a literary balance that you can move it with your little numbers. There's a balance in the kind of even the phrases.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If we speak in terms of stanzas, how many stanzas would you say there are? I'm not going to try to put this to music, but if how many groups, how many large groups or stanzas?
Two.
Two? Okay. Where A and B start, we could say the stanza starts if we speak in terms of stanzas. Okay, how many units within each stanza? Well, you could think of that one and one prime. By units, I guess I do mean lines. And we would then see six units within each stanza. Now, within each stanza, for example, is there a theme or themes that pop out at you?
Oh. What will and will not happen?
Pardon?
What will and will not happen?
All right. All right. You see in that first stanza, for example, in A1, the theme of that stanza is what will not happen. The theme of the second stanza, you might say, is what will happen. Okay? Now, within those units, within each line, say of the first stanza, A, and the six lines that follow, first over on the right, I have written down some of the themes and so on. Is there a theme that is common to both stanzas that you see specified or highlighted
give
on the right?
Give request.
Give, request, okay. Do those themes come at a certain point within the stanza?
Mm-hmm. Beginning and end.
Beginning and end. That is the theme of give? Mm-hmm. Okay. So in the first stanza, right, give is in the first unit, you might say, and in the sixth unit. In the second stanza, beginning with B there, give is a theme in the first unit, the first line there, and also in the last line. Okay? Is there another theme that is common to both stanzas?
What happens to the request?
Okay. What happens to the request?
Friendship.
Friendship?
Duty. I think it's duty or honor.
Okay. You have duty mentioned there. Okay, for example, duty appears in the middle of the first stanza and honor in the middle of the second stanza. Okay.
Well, I think we ought to go back and decide why this, what kind of a friend he was that came around at midnight. Why would he come, no matter what kind of a friend he was, to come bother him at midnight?
Mm-hmm.
I think we ought to decide that, why he, are you a good friend or a bad friend when you come bother your friends at midnight?
Okay, let's take that up in 1 second, okay? Okay. One other thing I'd like to mention from literary observation here is that you'll notice that that there's a flip-flopping here, or an inversion. That is, in the first unit of the first stanza, it's a positive thing. Friend, mend me 3 loaves. It's a declarative request. In the sixth unit there, which is, you might say, 1', it says, I cannot get up and give you anything. So it's a negative response to a request. Okay, so you have the asking in the first unit, the negative response in the last unit of that first stanza. Now, when you come to the second stanza, B there, there's an inversion. There's a flip-flop. You see, in the first unit, though he will not give him anything, there's a negative that it starts out with. You see, and then in the last unit, the very last line then, give him whatever he wants, we have a positive statement again, a declaration. That's another literary feature of the way these stanzas are organized. Any other observation on the literary character of the way this is set up?
We went to the parable of the vineyard where the man said he wouldn't go out to work, but then he did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, my point in putting it down this way, and we're going to talk about literary character of these passages each time we talk about a parable this week, is to show that there really is a structure, a rather unique structure. I mean, you find this when you're studying the Old Testament a lot too, the Psalms and so on, real literary structure. That you don't always imagine or think of right away as you read it. It just seems to be a story with possibly a theme or a point to be made. And often you look, like in a miracle story, to the very last verse or so to see, is this the point that's being made? But there is a literary structure, a character to this. And I think that helps me anyway, as I read a passage, to try to determine whether there is a theme that is meaningful to me, what interrelationship, if there's a main theme and some sub-themes, or if there's one theme, or if there are only some sub-themes and no main theme. Getting a handle on it this way is helpful to me, I know. Now, let's go to the question that you raised. What kind of a friend would this be to go to another friend at midnight, a late night visit? I mean, can you imagine yourself in your hometown going next door or across the street or wherever at midnight to ask for, what do we get asked for, Gene? Some oregano, some whatever to finish up that recipe that someone's working on?
Well, in our hometown, we wouldn't have to because we'd go to the all-night grocery.
Okay.
Also, it was much more important in those days than it was today to set something before a visitor when he came.
Okay.
It was really prime and important.
Well, if I had a friend, he's my friend.
That's right.
And it doesn't matter to me or to him whether I'm the asker or he is. Whether he comes to me at 12 noon or 12 midnight, he is in need.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Jesus makes any particular point of telling when you should help your friend. He doesn't say, do it when you're up and feel like it.
Okay.
More than that, he wasn't asking for himself in a sense. He said, I have a friend who just arrived on a long journey. And I need to, there weren't any all-night diners. I need to offer him something for his comfort at the end of the day.
That was before McDonald's.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we don't have all-night grocery stores in our town either. But what about this friend who's coming to visit in the first place, the one who's coming from a journey? How often do you get visited by somebody who has not let you know that they're coming? And who knows what time this friend arrived, maybe 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock that night? In other words, is this scene at all realistic in terms of your own experience?
Not in terms of our experience, but in those days, communications were essentially nil. You can't telephone.
I think it's in terms of our experience.
We've had these nice visitors.
Well, he's either a pest or he has utter confidence in his friend.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
Got to be one or the other.
Uh-huh. I wonder if he's gone to his friend before to with a similar request. Maybe things turned out a little better that time, huh?
Likely because of the first answer of refusal.
Well, the bread too could have been the meal, couldn't it? Where today a bread is just a side dish to us. I mean, the bread was the meal. They didn't keep as much food in their homes.
Well, they did. In the Middle East, in those days, they didn't make bread every day. It was a basic ingredient of meals. But a number of commentators feel that bread was viewed as the basic element, but somewhat tangential to the common dish, the casserole or what have you. But the bread was used certainly a very substantial part of the meal, but not necessarily the main course. But it was, you would never serve a meal without bread.
I still think that this is a dealing in friendships. And who's telling this story anyhow?
Jesus.
I think it's more than that. I think it goes back to your basic philosophy of life that it might not even have been a very good friend who came. But if you're the kind of person who is giving and loving, the individual would know that you would make some kind of a welcome. And then if you didn't have it, you turn to whoever is close at hand who is a good friend to help you out. And
I knew that.
I certainly wouldn't wake anybody up at midnight if it wasn't a good friend.
Back here?
There just seems to be one sort of grammatical point that might help clear things up too, and that is that at the end of verse 7 there's a question mark, which means that that whole first section is really a question, or in other words, what's being said is not that who has a friend who would come at midnight, that's not really the question, or, and it's not a statement that the friend would not get up, it's rather it's a statement that who would refuse to get up.
As I read that and got to the question, I wondered how I should have handled it. You know, that's kind of strange to come to that and see a question mark mm-hmm. at the end of that sentence.
Mm-hmm. Who, to whom is Jesus speaking here?
The people that he's addressing. He's telling the story and he's saying, can you imagine this situation? And then he tells the whole situation, question mark.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you had the word that in front of it, my children are in bed with me, but I cannot get up and give you anything. So, I mean, it could have been read that way, you would have gotten the significance of that question mark, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. But I think what he's really getting at is who can imagine getting in this situation and having your friend refuse to get up. Mm-hmm. So the question mark is for that whole section.
Yeah, agreed.
It's a rhetorical question. The answer is no.
Yeah.
Who can imagine not getting up? None of us can. We all would.
Mm-hmm. That's the key is in verse 5. Which of you? See, he's addressing his disciples. Which of you now? If you were in this situation, which of you would refuse a late night visitor like this? And then he baits it more by pointing to the excuses that the person who's been sleeping uses. What are those excuses for being put out by an interruption this time of night?
They all slept in one bed for one reason.
Okay.
The door is shut. Mm-hmm. Already locked up for the night.
Mm-hmm.
Finally got the kids quiet.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to disturb anything.
And if they have a child who's, say, 6 weeks old or younger, you can imagine the person in the house has probably been walking the child back and forth, trying to get the child to fall asleep so that he can get to sleep. And you know how it is, you walk around with tiptoes or bedroom slippers. if you finally get the child off to sleep, then if a siren goes off or there's some loud chatter outside, your whole plan is down the drain. And you're walking the child for another 3 hours. That was sure true with our second child. I went through a lot of those. But in other words, there are, Jesus I think is pointing to some rather feeble excuses for not responding to this friend. Do you agree? I mean, we don't even know that this friend who comes to the person sleeping knocks on the door. He says to him, maybe he sees a dim light on in the window, and hey, Joe, are you awake? And it's me, and I need some help. He asks for bread. Okay, do we know that the person doing the asking has the other things that he needs for the meal, for serving this friend who has come on a long journey? In other words, is this just one of many stops that he has made, requesting what he needs to take care of his visitor?
Well, don't tell me. He went up and down the street and got something from everybody.
I wonder if it's just bread alone, this would be any need that needs to be met this urgent.
Okay, is that specified in the passage anyplace?
No, I don't say so.
Nothing
is
said.
I have nothing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how about the last three words in verse 8?
He will get up whatever he wants.
Give him whatever he needs.
Whatever he needs implies that this might be his first stop. I mean, if he needs a lot more things that he's short of, might be his first of many stops.
Why does he ask for 3 loaves?
Well,
that's all he could get. All he needed.
Well, they ate a lot of bread in those days. It was a cultural custom that they would not give a half a loaf or a partial loaf. It always had to be the whole. Maybe this friend has some other people with him too, or with her. We don't know who the friend is that's been on the journey. Maybe it's more than one person, even though it implies one.
A loaf of bread was only a large hamburger bun size.
Maybe you wanted to give him one for the journey.
Maybe he's leaving at 6 in the morning again.
Let him take a full loaf with him.
Do you see these as feeble excuses? It struck me that that this really is importunity, and these are rather good excuses. I mean, hospitality may well be expected, customed, duty, but to finally get the whole house closed up and everybody off to bed, and by implication, since all are in one room, than to rouse the whole house again. That doesn't seem like a feeble excuse. Sounds like a pretty good one to me.
Mm-hmm. If you were the sleeper and someone called, I mean, you would want to give some excuse, perhaps, depending on your relationship.
Just go the other way. Suppose you're the guy that's out there in your shirt and you're hurting. Your pride isn't going to be very, very strong. I mean, you have a need, and you're desperate. And you go to see if that need won't be met, and you it says here you go to a friend. You don't go to a total stranger. You go to a friend. And that keeps coming back to me all the time. You grumble in your beard. Of course, I don't have one, but then I grumble anyway. But I get up and I go do it. And why? I don't know. You just do. This is the thing you do. And when you go back again to bed, you can go to sleep because you know you've done what you should do. And if you refuse, you lay there and toss, and there's that little thing inside that gnaws at you and say, well, I guess it should have. But I didn't, so you turn over, but sleep doesn't come. I mean, these are the kind of thoughts that run through my mind on these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
In verse 8, it tells the whole purpose of it, and that's the persistence of the man. And just prior to that, the disciples had asked Jesus to teach them to pray, and the whole thing is just a parable to tell us, too, to be persistent in prayer. And that's what it says in 8. Because of his persistence, he will get up and give him as much as he needs.
Okay, that word is, that's the word you have in your translation? What translation is yours?
New American Standard.
Uh-huh. Do others have that in your translation, the word persistence?
Importunity is what they have.
Either importunity or persistence. Uh-huh. Okay, I want to explore that word and the implications a little bit more in a minute. The question of friendship is a function both of the relationship between these two particular people in previous encounters. That is, can be just a one-on-one relationship through other experiences they've had together. As some like to point out, it's more a function of the sense of community that exists in that village or in the Middle East generally. A sense of community that one might have differently in a place like Holden than in a place like Spokane or Seattle. And so the question is, by the sleeping person refusing this friend's request, does that have a certain effect upon the whole community atmosphere toward helping out people who need help? Is there an underlying community feeling where as Jesus says to the disciples, you cannot help but respond positively to this kind of request. You've got some good excuses or not so good excuses, depending on how you feel about your relationship maybe to this particular friend. But can you leave that aside and think in terms of the larger picture of the community of Holden or something, and the need and how that, how the general feeling is all for one and one for all or something. Faith to go out in good courage. This guy has a lot of courage, maybe, to go to a person at midnight. Maybe the sleeping person will just throw something out the window and try to drive the person away. Maybe it's a path. There's that individual relationship between these two people built over time. But there's also the question of the community relationship. And in the Middle East, a guest is viewed as the guest of the community and not just of the individual. So that a person coming on a journey, it's a community concern to take care of that person's needs. And therefore, for a sleeping person or whatever time of night, whether or not they are good friends or not, on a one-on-one basis, the needs and the goals and the of the community can take precedence over the particular feelings of one person toward another in that particular moment of need.
Can I say something without anyone taking a kind of bullhorns or something? Back in the 50s, I had an orchard, and I lived on this orchard, and the road that went by me was narrow. On one side was a rather deep ditch, and I could have made a pretty good piece of change during the winter time, getting up in the middle of the night and pulling people out of the ditch, simply because they got over too far. They weren't intoxicated. There wasn't a question of why was it there, and then why weren't they home in bed like I was, but they were in trouble. And they came and they hammered on my door, and I sure didn't have any ice for anything. Stuff. And sometimes there was some children with them, sometimes just a boy and his girlfriend, sometimes another couple, but they would go by, they were going home. Why they were going by there, were there weren't many houses, won't be orchards, I don't know, because I didn't question it. They had a need, and I had a tractor, and a snowplow blade on the front of it, and a chain on the end of it. So I got up and shagged out and helped them. There was a need, that's all. There was nobody close by.
I think your point that the need of the community at that time was very, very strong. Had he refused to have help, that word of word would have gone out the next day very quickly. You know, that your friend came to this friend next door down there and did not respond. And his name would probably be Mud from then on, because he had received that kind of help. He was standing in the community, he would have been lowered, and I'm sure that he would have been thought of as less than good friend to anybody because he had received that. There's no question to them that they respond to community needs.
Because you know he's going to go on to the next person, you know, if he gets refused where he is. How about excuses? Is the sleeper, the person sleeping, one lacks community spirit because he, you know, looks to excuses first, like we often like. I mean, there are emergencies and then there are other kinds of needs. I have a friend who lives out in the country, who lives right around the corner on the highway, and he's got a deep ditch too. He tells me about the same sort of thing. People come in there, and many times he does not get up or he does not answer the door. You know, depending on what time of night it is. That's a natural response, I suppose. It's often kids, figures that are just out raising cane and so on. You know, the fact that this person in the house gave those excuses may or may not reflect upon others in the community. Would others give the same excuse? Or just a person who is not trying to a maverick in the community who does not really foster the sense of community like other households do.
I don't think Peter tells this story. Not get in touch with the rest of the community if you don't do something. You do it because you want to. I mean, he points this out. I can understand it, how people feel, and we need to be respected by our neighbors and our fellows, and there is a sense of duty to the community in general. But somehow, I don't understand why that I should get up in the night, because I think the rest of the community is going to hate my inner sport because I don't. Or they might say that he's a jerk, whatever he said to each other in that day. I hope I don't ever get stuck around his place or whatever. See, you serve people, and in serving people, we serve God and we serve you because we want to, not because some guy twisted our arm, or not because the preacher pounded on the pulpit the Sunday before, and we thought we better get with it. Maybe I'm going way off on left field here somewhere.
I think you're hitting an important point there. You got up and did that not because you knew the person, but because they were friends, and maybe not so concerned about what other people would say, but because you felt that responsibility inside. You wouldn't have felt right about yourself if you hadn't. I think that's what they're saying here too, that responsibility towards community, responsibility towards other people.
I'm sort of grateful that Luke included his excuses, because I think all of us operate out of the mixed feelings, and we certainly know what we should do and what we ought to do many times, but we don't always feel like it. And somebody mentioned this other parable about I won't go, but he did. And I kind of think that's how we are as human beings. Frequently, we may not verbalize our excuses, but we may run them by in our head, but ultimately we go and do the thing that for somebody else is good anyway, because that is...
Or we don't do it.
Well, but I mean, we make that choice, having run by the excuses, but if by and large our life is motivated by serving others in the name of Christ, we nonetheless, on occasion, think about, you know, I hope nobody asked me anything today, but if they did, you'd do it. And so to me, it simply shows the guy's human nature, but in his own head, he said, well, I won't do it for friendship, but I will for honor. So something motivated him finally to agree.
I would just like to say that the last several comments may all well be true. This parable is the intersection is bracketed on both sides on the topic of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we're getting a feel.
Yeah. And another remark about the comments may be true, but is it the point? The response, it seems to me, is not. That is to say, Jesus is not directing the question in such a way that one focuses upon that person responding. The focus is upon the disciple doing the asking. And so if there are things to be drawn from it, it's probably not from the response. If there are things to be drawn from it, it's to be drawn with respect to the one persisting.
Okay, let's ask about that word. Importunity or persistence. What are other possible synonyms? What does importunity mean? Are there other possible meanings to that word?
Begging.
Pardon?
Begging.
There's a footnote that for this word persistence in this Bible, it's shamelessness. In other words, he wasn't ashamed to ask at that hour, and he was just persistent.
Okay. Does the word, let's find out, to whom does the word really refer? Does it refer to the one doing the asking or the person who's been sleeping? Who?
The one doing the asking.
Yeah.
OK. say. Now, if it's the one doing the asking, and the theme is possibly one of prayer, does that imply that the more you persist, the more you badger, to use a maybe stronger word, God, the more likely your prayers will be answered? Is that the theme here? If that's what the word means, persistence, and if the one coming to the sleeper is the one who is persisting, that then that is what the Christian can and possibly should do in relationship to God, in approaching God in prayer?
Not giving up.
I'm wondering if there's an underlying feeling of trust. You trust that friend to respond, and because of this trust, then you can draw in your greatness of courage. You come with this feeling that it will all work out because he is your friend and you trust him.
But it's not a question of your friend. The reason why he gives you what you need is because it's something internal to him. Even though he wouldn't do it because he's your friend, he's still going to do it because of the way he is.
No, because of the badgering.
Yeah, because
no, but the reason, you know, it's not a question of your being a friend or something, but he does it for you. He does it because of his own reason.
Yeah, the text says he does it because there may be internal reasons,
but it's not a question of friendship. It's not something you have done for him that makes him reciprocate. It's something you're doing to him right now. Mm-hmm. And also, I don't know, that thing about midnight, how important midnight is. That is, you know, it's obvious it was not the same view. It was probably a bad at midnight. Now, is it a measure of his need that he did? You know, you could say, well, I'm sorry, friend, you're going to wake up tomorrow to eat. You're going to say, my friend, it's different. I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning. And instead, he says, no, I'm going to put that up and take care of it.
I think the intent was for it to be viewed as an imposition.
You impose upon them. And they don't know because you're a friend to them, because you've done the exact thing for them. They respond because of their own.
Mm-hmm. So you're suggesting that the word importunity may apply more to the sleeper. The word, you see, we said shamelessness is one way to translate that. Persistence. In the handout, you see the phrase avoidance of shame. Now,
I just went and looked it up.
What's the answer, John?
Well, the answer is importunity, but at least according to the Oxford English Dictionary, which is a fairly reputable source, nothing is mentioned on the four definitions about shamelessness. An awful lot is mentioned about troublesome persistence. And it seems to me that the emphasis then is put on the visitor and not the visitee, if you want to call him that. The person is really being a pain in the rear end who is knocking on the door. And I think that's an important point. That's important because it seems to me that what Jesus is talking about here is not so much the motivation of the sleeping person to help. I don't know if you read through the Gospels, you get an idea that Jesus has a pretty good understanding of kind of the basis of human nature. And it seems like what maybe he's saying here is that in spite of how creepy we all are most of the time, if someone comes and knocks on the door and has a need, for whatever motivation, he doesn't explore that a whole lot in this parable, but for whatever reason, we still get up and get him bread. And maybe there's a larger point being made there. Okay. Yeah.
I would say that the one way to find out what importunity means here is to do the Greek work on it, as opposed to the Oxford Dictionary, which would tell us English definitions that were current within our century. I think it'd be better to find out what importunity meant in the Greek. And the other thing I suggest is this parable is not about me, it's not about hospitality, and it's not about you. Mm-hmm. This parable is about God. It may be about me secondarily, but that's only a secondary application, I suggest. We want it to be about us. We think that they... my inclination is to want every parable to be about me, but I don't think they are. I think they're about God. And the parable ends sort of up in the air. We have to finish the parable. I think it's a parable that says, it's a how much more parable. I think what it says is, if this person would get up in the middle of the night and give a friend the bread, how much more will our loving Father hear us? It's not about me or about hospitality. It's about God's graciousness. It's a how much more parable. If we would do this, then the parable ends. Then we finish the parable in our own mind by answering, then how much more would a loving Father care for us?
The thing, God is a God of honor. And if he is a God of honor, can we come to him with our request, feeling safe that he will act justly with those requests?
Would he tell it up to the time
or not? Well, doesn't matter. If we say the word means persistence, and if it's the person coming to knock at the door who is a persistent person, is the theme any different? I mean, does that imply that if we persist, or... I mean, this is a strong word. It doesn't mean if we just regularly come to God in prayer. It's a rather strong word here. The Greek, you could say, implies more this phrase, avoidance of shame. If that's what importunity means, then it's the sleeper to whom the word importunity refers. See, in order for him to avoid shaming himself or the community, he has to say, in spite of my excuses, I will give you whatever you need, not just the bread.
Well, I read it so that it says a need, and God says he will fulfill our needs, but not our greed. And he stated here that it was a need, definitely, and it says, and I tell you, ask, and it will be given you. Well, we know that he's going to supply needs and not greed. Our greeds are... And so I think this is where your persistency comes to, that it was a need.
It's bracketed by the sense of God's Father and we are there for the children. And you think of how these children are such a small ones, when they need something, they come to you for it, right? But how do they come to you? You know, they don't wait for an opportune moment, the right time. They don't make up all the excuses necessarily. Or sometimes they will. Sometimes they do. You know, because Bye-bye.
Mine are never that way. They're not unfortunate.
That is, would your children go up to some stranger and say, I need something?
Yeah.
If the emphasis is on the one who's asking, does it have something to say to us who are afraid to ask? Who wouldn't ask for that open bread to feed our guests? Who would do without and more persistent and who never get anything? Because a lot of people are like that, even with prayer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like last night at the service, during the three prayers, one person asked for rain for the Midwest and for the hostages. To some of us, maybe some of us would not ask for things that specifically. I mean, all of us have prayed, I think, for the hostages. But when things like weather and so on, some of us think that God only knows what will happen, and that we, you know, who are we to ask for something that specific? But maybe this is what is being said, is that we do need to be a little more deliberate in what we do ask for, because God is an honorable God.
Because he asked for a loaf of bread, and I think that that's a lot of work. But he got it. He went for it.
Isn't it, even though your study stopped at 8 here, but isn't the key and the answer here what Jesus is saying by pointing out this parable? He said, I say you ask and it shall be given to you. See,
and knock, and in the footnotes it says, keep on asking, keep on seeking, keep on knocking. And it seems to me that this should end there rather than, or even in another verse, rather than at 8, because that's the gist of this whole idea of him pointing out this persistent person who had a need at an ungodly hour, if you will, and he went to his friend, and certainly our Lord is our friend, and then he says, just keep on asking, that's what I want you to do. And then he goes on, of course, telling more how the Heavenly Father is going to give more to us. This is what it, saw, what it says to me, just to keep on asking.
So is it a double point? One, the character of God, and Jim's remark of how much more. And the second point, an address of Jesus to the disciples that they in fact err on the side of having too little courage and their expectations are too diminished. So that they should be persistent, ask for more, keep on asking, don't expect too little.
Mm-hmm. Right, this is what Luke does time and again with parables, with miracle stories, with other things. He points to the nature of God. God is a many dimensions. And he paints pictures, parables, miracles, and so on, to point to one aspect, one color of God at this time, to show them the depth of God's nature. And then to say, now, in view of the way you have been acting and responding to individuals in need, are you really keeping foremost in mind what God is really like? And here is a common sense situation. God does want to be approached time and time again. He is unfathomable. You can apply all the attributes you want, but this is showing in a particular case that the disciples do need, in their own ministry to others, to point to the wonder of God, that he is approachable, and that he needs to be approached again and again, because that builds faith as we get in regular habits of doing things. In the most mundane needs, the loaf of bread, the most highest emergencies, like a car stuck in a snowy ditch, 20 below zero, all of these are legitimate needs. And we have a friend in God.
I think there's a sense of humor here in what Christ is like by using a story that sort of shows all of us, you know, that we're really very human, and he is too, an understanding that we are all typical, this person. We really don't want to get up. And at the same time, he's implying in this story that you can come to him at any hour, even midnight, and he is there and faithful and will answer. And that we should do likewise then. But it's sort of implying his faithfulness that he is there no matter what hour we come. But he gets that humor in there too to make us feel comfortable, and I think that's what he's doing with them. Sounds crazy, but we like that. And they grumble and so forth, but we'll do it.
Yeah,
great. Down in Pickleton. We were resistant to that. How many mothers, and I would say fathers, but mothers seem to have the upper hand on it, have prayed for some child going astray or whatever, year upon year, even. They never gave up praying. Some son in a Vietnam prison camp that he referred. Year upon year, and everybody said it's useless. But they resist. They keep going. They keep praying on the same prayer over again. In absolute trust and faith. And this is, and who did he pray that trust and faith to? The department of some bureaucratic outfit in Washington, D.C.? No. To God, they pray. And the position pays off one way or another. In the knowledge that the prayer is answered, but not the way they would like it to be answered. The prayer has finally been answered, or a phone call. Hey, Mom, I'm all right. I'm coming home. Or whatever. And to me, just because God doesn't answer the prayer the way you think he should, when you think he should, and how he thinks he should, it should be done, does not mean that God is not going to answer that prayer. They're not here. And so you persist. Not because God has to know about it, because he already does, but he wants to hear from you. And God, hear you ask.
God has a sense of time that we cannot fathom.
Right.
We have our own sense of time. Right. And we sometimes expect our sense of time to match with his very quickly. Sometimes we understand that it's a long-term sort of thing, but we do. Luke here says, God is this sort of being, and you as disciples are to keep asking. Come to him often. He is, the depths of your needs are real, but they can all be accommodated by the depth of God's power. I think what we'll do is stop for now. Tomorrow, now there is a different literary structure to the next few verses. And there is possibly a bit of a different point. There's also another parable that I'm going to bring in that occurs later in Luke that relates to this whole thing. But we will, people have felt that there is a literary, there are three parts to these first 13 verses, that is, verses 1 through 4, stand by themselves, 5 through 8, and then 9 through 13. So we will look at 9 through 13 together, also in relation to another parable tomorrow, to see whether it is distinct in terms of theme and so on from the verses we have just discussed today.